Welcome to the 20th and final episode of Chesapeake, Season 1 of the Fly Fish Forever podcast, presented by Fly Fishers International. This week, we'll be meeting with Andrew and Eric Breaker of the Breaker Brothers Fly Fishing Media Group. Andrew and Eric joined me on a 7-day road trip covering 1,200 miles as we drove around the Chesapeake Bay watershed this past spring. We documented 7 distinct fisheries, one each day, and met with 9 different anglers and conservationists from the region. We're going to talk about some of the behind-the-scenes stories, as well as what lessons we learned as we made our way around this amazing region. As always, I'd like to thank our sponsors at Costa Sunglasses and Cheeky Fishing for making this entire campaign possible, and I'd like to thank you, the audience, for tuning in, and I hope that you enjoy this final episode. Welcome to the final episode of the first season of the Fly Fish Forever podcast. I'm really excited to welcome Andrew Breaker and Eric Breaker of the Breaker Bros brand. You can find them on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, and anywhere else where fly fishing content can be found. Also, Andrew and Eric played a really huge role in the making of the Chesapeake campaign as presented by FFI and sponsored by Costa and Cheeky. They were the filmmakers that joined me on the 7-day journey in a camper van across the Chesapeake Bay watershed, making the Chesapeake Tales YouTube series, as well as the short film Chesapeake, coming to next year's International Fly Fishing Film Festival. Andrew and Eric, thanks so much for being on. We're going to start with Andrew because you're the older brother. Why don't you go ahead and just tell me a little bit about yourself?
Andrew, first of all, thank you so much for having us on. We've been really looking forward to finally reliving this experience. It was so much fun traveling around with you. To get things started, I guess we should start with where Eric and I are from. We were Marylanders. We grew up in a little town called Brookville, which is located just between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. And we both went to school through Maryland Public Schools. I went to St. Mary's College of Maryland for undergrad and studied environmental studies. Went on to get my master's at Johns Hopkins University, again, environmental studies. And I'm now living full-time, not in Maryland. I moved out to Colorado. I'm calling from Fort Collins, Colorado right now. So you could say I'm a bit of a Chesapeake sellout, but I definitely still call the Chesapeake and Maryland home. So that's a bit about me.
And then Eric, as the dweeby little brother, why don't you just go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'd like to start off by saying I don't appreciate those words, but Andy pretty much covered the basics there of our origin story. So we grew up in Maryland, kind of exploring the waters of the Chesapeake Bay. And I actually ended up going to undergrad at Susquehanna University, where I was a business student. So I was a marketing major. And I kind of also got to fall in love with the waters of central Pennsylvania there. So fishing Pence Creek. And I guess a hobby, I should say, that I've always kept up my whole life is kind of storytelling and video production. And that's something that started at a young age that never stopped. So kind of combining my two passions of the outdoors and conservation, as well as storytelling and videography, was very natural. And our first larger scale project was a journey upstream that we worked on together. And eventually that's kind of transformed into other projects in the Breaker Bros brand and eventually led us to you, Andrew, where we were able to go on this amazing trek across the Chesapeake Bay watershed.
Yeah. And it, I mean, we'll get into the films, I think, a little bit later, but I mean, really the inspiration for the Chesapeake campaign for me was seeing the film, A Journey Upstream, that the two of you made. I happened to be friends with one of the subjects. I actually know both Sean and John, Neely, as well as Sean Kimbrough, but talking to John about kind of being in your film, he had reached out to me and we chatted about it. And then watching it myself, and I was like, you know, it's a really cool concept, talking about brook trout and stripers in the same film. And I remember thinking, what if we took this to the extreme and really expanded and showed just the full breadth of what the Chesapeake Bay watershed's all about? But let's talk about just Journey Upstream. That was the two of yours. That was your first real fly fishing film that you did. And to go straight to the fly fishing film tour with your first ever film, that's quite a jump to the big leagues, if you will.
Yeah, you could say that. And full transparency, that is the first film where we had the resources, the time, the experience, and where we went all in and made it happen. What a lot of people don't see are all of like the little films that only our parents watched and gave us praise for. Mm-hmm. And then we finally made it to that point where we could go all in and do something really cool.
Yeah. I mean, and kind of going back to what I was saying before, like for me, video production is kind of been a lifelong pursuit. You know, it started mm-hmm. with stop motion animation, Lego videos, and, you know, graduated to family vacation videos. And I'm sure we'll get into it at some point, but a YouTube channel I had with a friend called Bass Bound Fishing, where we made weekly bass fishing tips. So it really, like Andy was saying, it's like, that was our first big project that like we really put a lot of effort into and wanted to make into like a great short documentary. But there was definitely years and years of creating subpar content and practicing and building to that point, for sure.
Yeah, and to be clear, I was not going to bring up Bass Bound Fishing on the episode. So way to out yourself there, Eric. Unfortunately,
go check it out, everyone.
Unfortunately, you're going to have to dig deep into the internet archives, I think, to find any trace of it. But Eric, who's now a strapping young man of 23, if you want to see him at his joyful sort of 13, 14-year-old awkward phase on YouTube, do a good deep Google search and you might be able to turn up some nuggets of Bass Bound Fishing. But you know, at Journey Upstream, it was really interesting for me to see kind of that it's such a sort of jarring's not the right word. It's such a striking stark difference going from, you know, Western Maryland in basically a pine tree sort of mix of hardwood, pine tree forest of the upper Savage on a brook trout stream, and then the big open spaces of the bay. And I remember being kind of struck by, you know, I'm really more of a trout and bass angler. I spend most of my time in freshwater further up the watershed. But then seeing that film, it was like, oh yeah, all this water is going there. Yeah, it was interesting. So, I mean, kind of chatting a little bit through what the hell were you thinking? Sorry, apologize for the language to the audience. Eric, what were you thinking kind of when I first reached out to you, kind of out of the blue, through John, but if I remember correctly, I actually just hit you up via Instagram.
Yeah, I distinctly remember you sliding right into my DMs, and I feel like I was hesitant at first because at that point, we were kind of starting to get more and more, I guess, leads and pitches for different films that, you know, a lot of times didn't pan out to be anything we were necessarily interested in. So I was definitely, I would say I was cautiously optimistic would be the words I would use. But I really liked the concept. I mean, the reason we made A Journey Upstream is because we were passionate about exactly what you're just talking about. Like the contrast between the small streams and there's small mountain streams of like Western Maryland versus like the big open bay, and the contrast of the two fish was like a just so much fun to like come up with like the imagery and to go shoot and fish for these two species. Mm-hmm. So the idea of like taking that to the extreme and like going to seven different fisheries like on one road trip, like that's nuts. So it definitely got me excited. And if I remember correctly, I pretty much immediately called Andy and kind of filled him in, and then we had our call and we were pretty much in after you pitched us the idea, because again, it was like A Journey Upstream. It's exactly what we were passionate about, but it was just taking it to the next level. So we were pretty pumped.
Mm-hmm. And kind of, I guess, looking at the Chesapeake tales, just looking at that 7-day journey, there was a lot of, I think all of us, but especially the two of you were, I think, a little bit, I don't know, intimidated may not be the right word, but I think, were we going to be able to pull off getting, I mean, we ended up driving close to 1200 miles in 7 days, along with having to find a place to sleep, figuring out how we're going to feed ourselves, but then also to go fish and film, because fishing while filming is a very different animal than normal fishing. I know I felt relatively confident we would pull it off, but I'm just kind of curious what you guys were thinking before the trip actually started.
Yeah, I would say we were terrified for sure. From a pure like technical video perspective, I think there was, we had a lot of conversations at the beginning of like, hey, like, we can't make this like some super cinematic, like dialed documentary style piece. Like it's going to have to be dumbed down a little bit, almost a little bit of like a vlog flair to it, like road trip, or else it's just not going to be possible. So it was daunting for sure. Cause I mean, It's not just like, even if you were to say, hey, you have to film 7 episodes in 7 days for like something, like that's scary in and of itself. But on top of that, it's like, you have to travel to the location. You have to meet with the expert. You have to fish. You have to hope you catch fish. And then you have to find a spot to sleep. And then you have to wake up the next morning and repeat in a new location. Like it was intimidating for sure.
Yeah.
I guess I have time to weigh in here.
Yeah, of course.
All right. Yeah. I mean, from the beginning, we were both so stoked on this project, but I immediately went to the logistics and my first thought was like, Eric, this is like everything we dreamt of with A Journey Upstream, like building this out to the max, but there's a reason why we chose two species for A Journey Upstream. And it's because, like if you want to experience the best of a fishing with no filming, you need days on weeks to get that 90 percentile fish. Mm-hmm. But if you introduce filming to the situation, you need even more time. So to boil that down into less than 24 hours, because you also need to travel to and from the next destination, mm-hmm. is insanity. if you maintain that high target of getting that fish in each fishery. So what we're hoping that our viewers are going to be able to do is to get on board with us and realize that what we're doing is crazy, and realize that you know, when we go smallmouth fishing, cobia fishing, bowfin fishing, striper fishing, we're not going to catch the biggest, best looking fish you've ever seen within that fishery. Mm-hmm. We're kind of getting little tidbits of each and putting together this massive epic journey.
That's what I love about it too, though, because I mean, it's kind of built into the premise. Like, that's the challenge. It's like 7 days, seven fisheries in one watershed. Like that's kind of built into the story. Cause for a journey upstream, like we shot that thing, you know, not super consistently, but in time we had, we shot it in like almost a year, like going out on different trips and gathering footage. And then we were able to sit on and be like, okay, we want to replace this. Let's go get an amazing sunset shot this weekend, or like target mm-hmm. these fish and try to get a big one. So it's like you had that luxury of time to really dial things in and like make the product as good as possible. Mm-hmm. Whereas this, we definitely did not have the luxury of time.
No. And I mean, it was sort of a insanity born of necessity, right? Was
exactly
the only way to real with all of our schedules. I mean, I work full time and I'm also in grad school. You guys both have busy careers. I mean, Andrew, you to fit it in, you're getting married what in a week?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you had your wedding to plan. You really had with the vacation days you get, like, this was it. You get 1 week. It was like, let's go. We got to get all this 7 days. And I mean, to be honest, I'm not sure how we were able to, in hindsight. I mean, you're just running on coffee, adrenaline,
Slim Jims.
And a lot of like, I don't know. I remember I made like chili or something that sustained us for a few days, but,
I don't think we had one Slim Jim that whole time.
Oh, you didn't. Okay.
I'm sorry, Eric. Beef jerky.
Thank you.
You ate a lot of beef jerky.
Yeah, I did do that. And we literally lived off of chili for the first 2 days.
Yeah. First 2-3 days was chili and like, turkey sandwiches. Let's talk a bit about like, so we've kind of laid the roadmap of, we decided to do something a little bit nuts and it ended up working out, I think, very well. But let's just kind of, so for the audience, and you're going to get to see this starting next week, next Wednesday, the first episode, Central Pennsylvania with Kate Fritz of the Alliance of the Chesapeake Bay and George Daniel, the famous fly fishing educator and head of the Penn State fly fishing program. That'll be our first episode. And it was also our first step on the trip. But we went on the seven locations that we went to were trout fishing in central PA on some of the limestone fed creeks and streams. We then drove from there down to Pendleton County, West Virginia, to one of the great brook trout strongholds of the Mid-Atlantic, where we met Dustin Wisherman from Trout Unlimited. You can learn more about him. He's been recently featured in Garden and Gun magazine. He was also featured on the Discovery Channel about the work that he's doing in West Virginia. Before we ended up in around Harper's Ferry meeting with Pamela Dunlap from Women, Wine, and Waiters, who's also the founder of International Women's Fly Fishing Day and was voted one of West Virginia's 50 Wonder Women, as well as Mark Frondorf, the Shenandoah River Keeper. Then DC, where we fished the Anacostia River for snakehead, as well as the Northwest Branch of the Anacostia for sunfish and little bass, with Fong Tru, who's the fly fishing expert, as well as a staff member from the Anacostia Watershed Restoration Partnership. Then down for bowfin fishing, about an hour southeast of Richmond, in the swamps, the primordial swamps. These swamps are actually millions of years old, for bowfin, one of the oldest living species of fish in the world. And then to Cape Charles for cobia on the fly, big open water, huge fish. You're talking 50 inches plus. And then we ended in Tangier Sound, fishing for striped bass, probably the most iconic fish species of the Chesapeake Bay watershed. But now, Andrew and Eric, obviously this is very repetitive. You guys have thought about this trip, been on this trip, and talked about this trip with me for many hours. But for the audience, that gives you a sense of kind of where we were going. I think our longest drive was 4 to 5 hours in one day, but every single day was probably 3 hours or so on the road. But it gives you a sense of kind of the range of places that we were fishing in. Let's kind of start with just for Andrew, what was your most memorable day of filming of the seven and why? And then we'll get to Eric.
You know, that's so hard. It's each destination was amazing in its own right, but I think I would go ahead and say the final day was my favorite. Just being able to look back at the full week and know what we were able to accomplish, and the last day was fishing for striper on the eastern shore of Maryland with my best buddy Jonathan Bland. We both went to college together. He's the one that actually got me into fly fishing, and I spent so many days with him fishing on his whaler through the Chesapeake Bay and doing that exact same thing. And to finish the entire week with him doing the same thing that we love to do was pretty awesome. After spending a week of exploring fisheries that I've never experienced before, you know, finishing with kind of the most classic, that was a fun moment.
And what about for you, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that that's a difficult question, you know, because I mean, it goes along with the theme, but each fishery is just so different that it's hard to compare. But if I had to say, the first one that comes to mind is definitely when we were fishing with Dustin in West Virginia, going for brook trout. It was the second day of the adventure, so we still had some energy, hopes were high, and just it was, that landscape blew me away. Some of those rock formations, Dustin was like one of the most knowledgeable and passionate individuals I have ever met. And it was just absolutely it was just amazing traveling around with him, watching him interact with the locals in the town and, you know, get access to some awesome private water from past projects he had worked on. And just that whole day was a blast. And then cracking some IPAs and walking around the valley and watching Dustin pull in some hefty brook trout that I didn't even know existed in this region. Mm-hmm. It was pretty special.
Yeah. And I mean, there were a lot of special days along the way and a lot of amazing moments, but the what Dustin and Trout Unlimited have accomplished in that part of West Virginia in terms of restoring habitat, improving water quality, but then seeing that manifest in a 16-inch brook trout. I mean, that's pretty wild. The only place I'm used to seeing brook trout of that size is in Maine or further north. And, you know, most of the brook trout we catch in the mid-Atlantic are like 6 to 8 inches, a trophy's 10, and to see like a thick fish and to know, I mean, Dustin has said his long-term goal is to restore the watersheds of eastern West Virginia to such a point that he's growing that they can support 20 plus inchers and that he thinks he's getting close. I believe him when he says it, because you can see some of that one restoration project on the farmer's land that we saw in particular, where they had, I mean, moved, I think hundreds of tons of soil and put all those basically massive trees that downed, you know, dead trees, and they basically like re-anchored the entire stream bed. I mean, that area looked like we were in Wyoming. It was the idea that something like that exists in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. And I've been around for a while and I've traveled a lot of the watershed over the years. I had no idea something like that existed where we live.
I completely agree. And one of my favorite line in all the Chesapeake Tales is said by Dustin when he says, "I have a dream and that dream is 20 inches long."
Yeah, that's a great line. And it's fitting. And I guess for me, I actually would say day three was in some ways the most memorable day for me. And that would be in part, that was the one day that really did not go according to plan at all. We were supposed to fish on the South Branch of the Potomac River for smallmouth with Pamela and Mark Frondorf. And now we're going to kind of start getting a little bit more into the realities of making film and, you know, kind of how does the sausage get made in fly fishing films? Because what you see, a 10 minute long or 15 minute long film, there's probably dozens, if not hundreds of hours behind, you know, those 10 minutes. But our third day, we were supposed to go fish this one particular place. And we actually had great weather because that was one of the top concerns, right? In a 7-day window, fishing in 7 different places, how are you going to get, and you start adding saltwater and tidal environments, how are you going to get the right tides, the right winds, but also just generally weather. And where we were going on the South Branch of the Potomac is a very famous section. It's called the Trough. I don't feel guilty naming it because it's very well known. It's a beautiful place. If you ever get a chance to go, I'd highly recommend it. But there's only one way in and one way out, and that's by boat. There is no valley. It is you are going through a gorge with high mounds on either side for 7 miles. In fact, the river used to run under the mountain range. It's a real bizarre geological feature where the South Branch actually went under a ridgeline and over a long period of time, millions of years, it hollowed out to the point that the ridgeline collapsed and the river then carved through the ridgeline. And so even though there's valleys on both sides, the river actually goes basically through the middle of the mountain. But when you have bad weather, there's nowhere to hide. So we had really bad thunderstorms predicted that day, high winds, lots of lightning. So we had to pull the plug and reschedule our day of filming with Mark and Pamela. Andrew, Eric, and I driving, we ended up deciding to go to another river that's a favorite of mine that I actually will not name because it is pretty small and you're going to have to kind of do your own homework and find it yourself. It is in the Eastern Panhandle, West Virginia, on the way back to Washington. It's a float that I've done many times. It's a great place for taking beginners. There's a lot of sunfish and small smallmouth bass that you can catch on top water, especially when we were there in early June. There also happens to be one of the most absurd waterfalls that feeds directly into the river that is so pristine and beautiful. It looks unnatural. It looks like you're on you're like a Disney World or something. It really is kind of hard to describe. And you go through a series of gorges and we caught, what would you say we caught? 120, 130 fish in like a 4 or 5 hour float. I mean, it was like almost every around cast. There. Yeah.
Yeah. It was absurd.
Yeah. And all on top water. It was nothing but poppers and wiggle minnows and I think maybe some sliders, but it was pretty much entirely top water action, uninterrupted from the minute we hit the water until the minute we got off. For me, that would be the most special day because it was completely unscripted and totally unexpected. So yeah, I would say day three for me. So we've ended up naming days 1, 2, and 3 as our most memorable. But anyways,
no,
2, 3, and 7.
Oh, you're right. 2, 3, and 7, not 1. My bad. Thank you. So then let's kind of, I guess the next question I would ask, with the benefit of a few months now since filming of hindsight, what would you say is the biggest takeaway that each of you have had from that 7 days on the road?
I would say it is worth it to push yourself. Kind of going back to what we were just talking about, like it was so daunting, the idea of filming and coming up with a short episode 7 days on a road trip. But in hindsight, like, I'm so happy that we just pushed and got it done. And it's not even like it wasn't enjoyable. Like, we had a blast. Like, I look back on that like it was a vacation almost, like, where when in reality I was that might be the hardest I've ever worked for like a week in my life. Mm-hmm. Like, it was no joke. But you know, I'm just super glad that we did it in hindsight. So I'd say that. Just glad that we pushed ourselves and got it done, because I think we're sitting on some pretty cool footage now.
I would say that I learned that the Chesapeake is even more diverse than I originally thought. And that's a line that, you know, we're scripted to say that it's the biggest estuary in the world.
Third largest. Yep. And then the largest in North America. Or second largest. And Hudson Bay is the biggest in North America.
So it's a really large estuary that's super diverse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of always burnt into my skull. But and you get the fisheries and, you know, the environments that you tend to hang out in. But until you go on an adventure that forces you to go into the 7 most dynamic and polarized of the watershed, it takes until then to realize, like, oh my gosh, I can be in the Appalachian Range, fishing for a brook trout on dries, then go down to the swamps of Virginia and catch a prehistoric looking fish on, you know, some sort of minnow imitation, and then go down to the mouth of the bay and catch cobia literally in the ocean. Until you go on that adventure, you don't realize how diverse it actually is. Mm-hmm.
I found ourselves, all three of us, a lot of different moments, kind of like standing back or sitting back and just literally saying out loud, like, I can't believe this is in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. Like, it feels like we're out west, or it feels like we're in another mm-hmm. country. Like, that was said a lot of times throughout the course of that week.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And to me, I mean, bowfin's a real passion of mine, and the places that they live, I love swamps. You know, I wouldn't want to like be in a swamp all the time, but there's something about being in a swamp fishing and just the sounds, the bugs, the birds. But where we went, and we're not going to name that spot, that is probably the most closely guarded just simply because of its fragility. But the swamp that we went to with Grant, the fact that you can find Spanish moss in the Chesapeake Bay watershed is kind of nuts. I don't know how else to say it. I mean, you feel like you're in the deep south when you go back in there. I felt like I was somewhere in maybe southern Georgia. And we were 3 hours from DC. The diversity, it just can't be overstated. And yeah, I think we said it over and over again. I feel like I'm in X. I feel like I'm in Y. I think that would be my biggest takeaway as well. But I like yours a lot, Eric.
Yeah. And it's also not even just the environments. Like when we were driving down there, we were maybe halfway through and we stopped to get gas, and just immediately it was like a gas station straight out of the South, like accents completely changed. Mm-hmm. And then we looked at each other and we were like, what happened? Like at some point in that, like 1.5 hour drive, like we ended up in the South from DC. Like everything changes so quickly. It's just wild how diverse culture and environments and everything is.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, I mean, just talking about the point of the Chesapeake campaign, you know, the podcast, the films, just more broadly, is one of the things that FFI, we really hoped to highlight about the Chesapeake Bay watershed was not just the diversity of the fisheries and the landscapes, but also kind of the cultures. I mean, the Chesapeake Bay watershed has been shaped by the movements of people for thousands of years. But you go to central Pennsylvania, you have Pennsylvania Dutch. You go to eastern West Virginia, you have Scots Irish. You go to, like you were saying, kind of in that Tidewater, Virginia area. I mean, that is incredibly Southern. And you are, like you said, we were an hour and a half from Washington, D.C., a very cosmopolitan kind of global city. And yet within a 2 hour drive, you could be in any of those three kind of subcultures right away. Not to mention, you know, the Anacostia River right in DC. I mean, that has a huge, the river itself has a huge relationship with the neighborhood of Anacostia and the African-American community, Black community around that river. So that was one of the other things we really wanted to showcase. And that was also kind of a choice, as the audience will get to see over the next 7 episodes, of the music that we chose. There's a logic behind the music that was chosen for every single episode. And because there's really no other way to spell it out, and you may not realize it otherwise, all of the music that you will hear over the next 7 weeks, every single one of those artists is from the Chesapeake Bay watershed. And their music really is of the place in which we're fishing, because it's made by people from those places. And so that I like that you mention kind of that you detect the culture immediately. That was something we really wanted to draw people's attention to as well. It's sort of like being in central PA. I just associate it with brown trout and George Daniel, right? Like it's just those two things, you know, and that culture of central PA, having lived there myself, it all feels very intertwined. When you catch that brown trout, you're pulling a fish out of the water that is non-native. It was introduced. And yet somehow culturally it feels, because it's a German fish and there's such a German heritage to the people who came from Europe to central PA, it feels so entwined in what makes central PA, central PA.
Yeah. And I think that was super important to us, this whole project. We weren't on a quest just to try to capture super awesome fishing footage. Like, yeah, that's, I hope that's a byproduct. And I think we definitely got some of that, but we wanted to show the unique environments and we wanted to show the culture. Like for this Pennsylvania video, one of my favorite shots was, I got a shot of a horse and buggy from like the Amish sitting in front of a Dollar General store. That just, like, to me, just embodies Pennsylvania. It's just that there's little shots like that that just add to the overall feel and culture of each episode. And then you throw the music on top of that. And then the fish species also fits in really nicely. And it's, I feel like our goal was to accurately portray that subculture of that region with the short video to the best of our abilities within the small time window. You know, of course, in an ideal world, I would love to spend 2 weeks on each episode and really dig deep and make sure we were like dialed in. But for the resources we had, I think we did a very good job.
Andrew, I see you. Looks like you have something you want to chime in.
I think Eric hit the nail on the head. Anything I say will detract from that. That was perfect. Way to go, Rick.
Thank you, Andy.
So I guess kind of, I'm trying to think kind of where we want to go next, but let's just kind of, we've talked about what each person's favorite days were. What was the biggest challenge that, what was the hardest part of the trip for each of you?
I know after I choose something, I know there's going to be a really good one that I think of, but the one that comes to mind, is the day that you were talking about, Andrew, where we woke up to bad weather in West Virginia and had to totally reorient plans. We thought we were driving home, and then on the way home, we ended up doing a float that you totally lowballed, and it ended up being so much longer than we thought. And we got off super late on the water and then had to drive back home late that night. And we hit thunderstorms on the way home driving through like Tyson's. And that, I was dead tired driving in that van through a thunderstorm. And I was just dreaming of being in my bed and just getting some sleep before we had to wake up and do another day.
Mm-hmm. I think my answer would be the same, just in the fact that that was kind of the middle of the week. It was kind of, day one was not as successful. It was a great day. Like, it was, we met with like some awesome people and like had a lot of fun, but the fishing did not go as expected. So we already got hit by we were kind of like day one didn't go as planned. Day two was amazing. And then when we had to cancel day three, I think we kind of hit a moment of like, uh-oh, dude, like this could go south real quick. Cause we knew our last 2 days were saltwater. So like you're saying before, tides, wind, weather, like that could change very easily. Mm-hmm. So the fact that our days that were supposed to be easy and set in stone were already looking rocky was scary. And then everything you just said, and a couple things you left out. One, I think the next topic we should go to after this is, we haven't really done the Green Machine justice yet.
I feel like
we need to set
and the Scott Broom. We need to talk about Scott.
Yeah, we need to talk about both of those. But on that night, so when we finished that float, which was a lot longer than expected, it was still a blast though. I'll give you that. We got back to the Green Machine, which was stuck in the mud.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a while of Andy revving the engine, me getting behind it, acting like I could push it, slipping in the mud, tweaking something in my back. And then finally Andrew made the U-turn and came and gave us the love tap and pushed us out of there. And then like Andy was saying, the rain hit. And I remember one moment in particular when you were driving super fast, Andrew, and you had the you had the fly craft on the back. And I don't know if you didn't know a railroad track was there or something, but you drove over the railroad track so fast. And I swear the fly craft got air underneath of it. And Andy and I were just like borderline crying, laughing.
Yeah. I mean, that was one, I think I have to say, so just for the audience, I own a raft and I have a very beat up mid 2000s Tractor Supply trailer. It's much loved, but much worn. Trailer that I used to tow my raft around on. And it managed to, I had some real misgivings getting on the road about just how much driving we were going to be doing with that thing behind us. And I do remember hitting that railroad track because I didn't see it really coming. I did not understand. I did not fully appreciate just how abrupt the grade change was. And I remember thinking, okay, the I either am about to break the axle or I'm going to break the the springs basically that support the axle on each wheel. I thought one of these is going to snap because they all have a lot of surface rust and I've done some work, but I thought for sure I'm going to be calling AAA. I'm going to be having to put the raft on the roof of the car and just limp home. And we really needed the raft for the Anacostia day the next morning, because that raft does very well in that area and we just needed two boats. I thought the trailer was done, and to its credit, it took it on the chin and just kept asking for more. And it's still going strong today. I think for me, the toughest day was actually day five. We had three tough days in a row in the middle of the week. The smallmouth trip on day three had been postponed because of weather. Day four with Fong, as awesome as it was to be on the Anacostia and be in DC and showcase what I think is a really special river in its own way. That was a tough day of fishing. And then you add in day five. That was a grind, and things were looking a little iffy coming into the end of day five, heading to Cape Charles, coming out of Bowfin, heading for Cobia fishing. That was when I started to get really worried that, the film project was going to end up being more of a testimonial to don't try this 7 days, seven fisheries is not going to work. And it, to its credit, it for the most part did, but yeah, that day five was definitely the point I had to kind of really gather myself and be like, we're going to make this work.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, we had to kind of have a team meeting.
Yeah.
And regroup. And we had that conversation of like, okay, what can we turn this into with the scraps that we have? So that was definitely our peak of our hero journey, I guess you could say. But for Andy and I, that night was one of the most special moments of the whole trip, because we, like you said, we were driving from Bowfin to the mouth of the bay to go cobia fishing the next day. And we stopped at Virginia Beach to pick up some seafood for the next night. And then when we got back onto the road, we kind of hit the lighting perfectly, and the sun was setting as we were crossing the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. And it was this really cool moment of like literally the bay to our left and the ocean to our right, and the sun was setting, the sky was golden and pink, and we were kind of just like, I feel like we were just in Penn's Creek, and green drakes were rushing by our face, and like we're already at the ocean and the sun setting and we're about to target cobia tomorrow. Like, I don't care that the film's not going as planned right now. Like, this is just so cool. So that was one of my favorite moments for sure too.
Yeah. Yeah. And so just chatting about the green machine, because people are probably wondering what the heck is the green machine. The green machine was the camper van that we rented from there's a website called Outdoorsy. You're welcome, Outdoorsy, for the free promo. But it's basically Airbnb for camper vans. And we had the rug pulled out from under us. We had rented a very picturesque, beautiful Westphalia Vanagon, you know, sort of the quintessential angular 80s camper van that we thought was going to be really photogenic. And the guy canceled on us, I think, like a week before filming. And so we were left scrambling to find a camper van, and we were looking for something charismatic for the film. And we ended up finding basically, I don't know how else to describe the green machine. It's the type of green you'd only see in like mint chocolate chip ice cream. And it's also like slightly lifted and has extra large tires. So it's actually a great camp, like great van for driving on a lot of the, we spent a lot of time driving on some pretty bad gravel roads, especially in Pennsylvania and West Virginia. It ended up being the perfect vehicle, but the guy who owns it in DC, his name for it is the Green Machine. And the Green Machine has some real funny quirks, which Andrew, Eric, I'm going to kind of let you guys talk a little bit about what made the Green, what makes the Green Machine such a special motor vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to dive into that.
I think there's two things I remember, Eric. Uh-huh. Well, the first one is that when you start it, you can't just turn the key in the ignition. You have to flood the engine a little bit with, and you have to accelerate, and you got to do it just enough so that you don't like that engine is loud. Mm-hmm. There was a couple of times where I like really, and you know, scared some people around me. But yeah, by the end of the trip, I got it down to a science. And then the second for me would be the air conditioning, in that it only worked not at all or at full blast, nothing in between. So, and not only that, it would change the temperature and the intensity depending on how hard the van was working. Mm-hmm. So there was a couple of times where we were going through the Appalachians where we were having to go up some hills, and when the van was really putting out some energy, the AC would just cut. It was like, we can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And then there was other times where we were coasting and the AC would just be on full blast on your feet, and your feet would just be completely frozen.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the initial ways I described the Green Machine to people was it's a van that you want to make sure not to drive too slowly past any playgrounds. I feel that gives a good vibe of the way that the van looked. But that, yeah, I think what Andy was just talking about would probably be one of the, you know, in the time, most annoying quirks, but looking back at it, one of the funniest. I remember at one point I literally was so fed up, I put socks on when we were driving because that AC was just pounding my feet and freezing. But the second we started climbing uphill, it's not just that the AC turned off, like the engine was working so hard that it started pumping like steaming hot air at my toes. So I was in this constant cycle of stripping my socks off and putting them back on until we got to the next location.
Yeah. But I will say this for the Green Machine. I mean, quirks and all, it was an absolute beast that just, we put it through the ringer. I mean, some of the roads we drove on, especially in Pennsylvania and West Virginia, I mean, you're talking about basically switchbacks on like deeply rutted, really kind of chewed up gravel roads in the mountains where if something happens, like there's no help for hours in any direction. And I felt pretty confident the whole time that the Green Machine was going to get the job done, and it did. So yeah, I think actually oddly a really charismatic vehicle in its own, it's not the prettiest vehicle and it, you know, right. It's not the Westphalia Vanagon or some, you know, it's certainly not a Mercedes Sprinter van or something, but like it was at the end of the day, I actually think it encapsulates better what we were doing than any of those other vehicles, because at the end of the day, this was we had to really get creative to make this work, considering we didn't have the budget to go spend a year in a Mercedes Sprinter van. We had a week in the Green Machine. So I actually really appreciated kind of what the van brought to the table.
Oh yeah. It first of all, it's its own character for sure in the film. And it fits the vibe perfectly of the Chesapeake watershed. Like, you know, if we were making a film dry fly fishing in Montana or Wyoming, like I don't think it would fit well. But if we're fishing the Anacostia, then driving to go catch bowfin, like it just completely fits kind of the storyline and the area and the whole like DIY accessible fishing trip that we filmed. So in a weird way, I think it was a blessing in disguise that we ended up with Green Machine.
So and then the kind of the other thing I said, we got to talk about Scott, and I very much think we do. We had a lot of great guests. We had 9 guests total, 7 episodes. We had 2 episodes with 2 guests and the rest were each one. But it really can't be overstated how much we owe to one individual, the man, the myth, the legend, Scott Broom, who Scott is not featured in any of the films. You will see him in episodes 4 and 5 in his towy skiff running around with a mud motor, which is a mud motor is a ingenious design developed for swamps down in the deep south that can basically push your it's called a mud motor for a reason. You can push certain types of boats over mud. It's similar to like having a jet in certain ways in terms of what it can do. But we would never have been able to pull off episodes 4 or 5 without Scott willing to help us out. And Scott is really just a legend in his own way. He's one of the more, the way I met Scott and got him involved in the campaign was I met him briefly in the morning out fishing at Fletcher's Boathouse. And then oddly enough, the very next day I went smallmouth fishing. This was late March, early April, kind of early season smallmouth, trying to find them in sort of their deep, sort of leaving their winter holds, but pre-staging before they actually started moving into shallower water at a boat ramp. And he said, "You want to come out and ride around in my towy with the mud motor?" And I was like, "I most certainly do." And so met him through that. And just, Scott has a great dog, Diego, right? Wasn't it Diego? Yeah.
Yep.
And just can't thank Scott enough for making the film campaign possible. And also just for bringing such a great attitude to those 2 days and just fantastic humor. So.
Yeah, he was one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life, for sure. And just could not have been more helpful, because not only was he there to provide, you know, a boat for us so we could get those angles, but he also, his whole career was kind of built around storytelling and video production. And he worked for, what was it, WUSA 9?
That's right. One of the local news stations in Washington, yeah. D.C.
So, I mean, he was just putting me in the perfect spots and giving me awesome recommendations of shots to get and just cracking me up all day too, which is important.
Yeah. We need to bring him on all future trips.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. Scott, just really thank, if you happen to listen to this episode, thank you again so much for helping us out. We really appreciate it. So then I think that kind of brings us to, you know, the guests that you guys got to meet along the way. I mean, Andrew, you didn't end up getting to meet a few, because you had to head back to, Colorado, but kind of just like Eric, ironically, is now, his boss at the time had never met her before. Kate Fritz, the head of the Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay, is now his boss. Eric now works for the Alliance. You know, a lot of great relationships, I think, developed. I'm kind of curious, you know, Eric, what was this like? What would be a really special memory you had with our guests? Kind of, you talked about Dustin earlier, but just.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously what you just said would be my first answer. Meeting Kate. And Adam Miller was there too, the director of communications. And then a couple of the board members came, Sean Kimbrough, who we had talked about, came, and Joe Evans. And it was such a fun like moment. Like there's so much energy. It was our first day. We get to hang out with all those people for a little bit before we were we were rushed off to our campsite. And that, you know, developed into my career now, which is pretty wild. So that was an awesome interaction, obviously. I'm trying to think of another moment. Yeah, I mean, like you said, Andy wasn't here for this one because we had to reshoot it because of the weather. But when we met up with Pamela and Mark, I don't feel bad name dropping this either because everyone knows it, but at Harper's Ferry, it was such a fun day. Both of them were incredibly awesome people to fish with, both very different people for sure. But it was a blast to kind of float down the Shenandoah with them and kind of hear about what they're both up to in their careers and kind of in the fly fishing space too. And then to sit down and interview them. And then we wrapped it off with some beers at a brewery on top of the mountain, that day was just a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Way to rub it in, Eric. That sounds like an amazing day.
Yeah,
it was. It was pretty great.
Yeah, we got I witnessed Pamela land a channel cat on the fly.
Yeah, that was fun. Neat.
Yeah.
So how about for you, memorable. Andrew?
I would say that the most memorable person that I ran into it on the adventure was Dustin Wichterman in West Virginia. I think going into it, Eric and I had very high standards for the brook trout segment because that is our favorite fish species, and that fish means a lot to us, and the environments that they live in mean a lot to us. And when we met Dustin and we experienced how awesome he is as a person, and then realized that his job is literally to bring back the native stronghold of I almost said cutthroat, of brook trout in the mid-Atlantic in that part of West Virginia. I think he just became like one of like the greatest people ever in our minds. And it just amazed me how amazing he was as a person. I can't stop saying the word amazing. But that's what Dustin is. Mm-hmm. And he lives a life of improving the fishery that we love the most.
Yeah. No, I mean, that day with Dustin really is, that's a day I'll kind of carry with me for the rest of my life. I mean, just the lighting, the weather, I mean, just everything came together. The fishing was incredible. But I would actually say it's a bit of a cop-out to say I loved all of our guests equally. And I really did. And I can't thank all of them enough for coming on a portion of the journey with us, but actually our last day of filming, going back to Central PA to do the extra day shoot and getting the chance to meet, I've met George Daniel in person before, but I've never fished with him or gotten to see him fish. And I would say seeing him fish was really it's sort of like if you go to the Kennedy Center in DC and you see a featured violinist or something, someone who has spent 10,000 plus hours at one particular thing and become such a master of their craft, to watch George Daniel kind of operate in his element in the state, you know, Central Pennsylvania on a Central Pennsylvania trout stream, just how dialed he has everything from his equipment, his rods and leader setups and the flies, but his casts, just the way he reads the water there. I mean, that one fish he caught came out of what I would have considered the most marginal water. And there was just something that he could detect there that I wouldn't see. And I consider myself pretty decent at reading trout water. I've done a lot of it. But I would never have thought, oh, that spot's going to hold fish. But he just, to see someone who has really mastered something that into that depth is I thought was really special to just be able to watch that. So that was really, really cool for me. And, you know, all of them were such great guests. Grant, you know, just the Bowfin world. It's just, I love the swamps, and, you know, Grant's truly, that's such a passion. But yeah, watching George, I think just in his element was really a special experience. Well, we probably do need to start kind of heading towards the finish line. I think probably got time for two or three more kind of topics or questions, before we wrap it up. My next question for both of you would be, I mean, for Eric, I think it might be somewhat obvious, but of an answer, because you kind of talked about it already, but how did the trip change you? I guess would be a question I would ask.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So my obvious answer is, I now am the multimedia associate for the Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay. So I've, you know, I wouldn't say it's solely because of that trip, but the trip was a big part of it and made the connection for sure that now my career trajectory is pretty much dedicated to the Chesapeake Bay watershed, which is pretty cool. And, you know, I found myself gravitating in that direction even before this. It's where we grew up. That's kind of what inspired us to, you know, we made a journey upstream, we came back, we started this project. So I would say it kind of just took that passion and made it stronger. Kind of what Andy was saying too, like we understand that the Chesapeake Bay watershed is super diverse and amazing. And that's why we made a journey upstream. But we didn't understand it was that amazing and that diverse when we actually took the time to go to 7 different locations and drive throughout it in 1 week. So I would say it took a passion and made it 10 times stronger, and just made it like undeniable that I want to keep pushing forward and with my career, especially in conservation. And, you know, right now with the Chesapeake Bay watershed specifically.
I think for me, it similar to what Eric just said, it further solidified my love for the Bay and my appreciation for it. And I think growing up in the area, it's always been like home, and it's the fishery that I kind of, or the fisheries of the watershed are the ones that I know the most and can speak to. And it's going on that trip just further solidified that, even though I live all the way across the country in Colorado, you know, in my backyard, I have the Poudre River and the Big Thompson River. And around here, those are the anglers, you know, you're a specialist at one of the two, or maybe both if you have enough time. And even though I spend a fair bit of time on those streams, I still recognize the fisheries of the Chesapeake as my home waters. I still know more about those waters than I do out here. And maybe someday that'll change, but
yeah,
with time. But yeah, I really still associate and identify with the Chesapeake.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for me, the Chesapeake campaign and the podcast and then the film trip in particular was, it came at a kind of particular moment in my life because, you know, my wife and I are expecting our first kid in January, and I'm not going to be able to go take 7 days off to go jump in a camper van and drive around the Chesapeake Bay watershed for probably 20 years. And also my wife and I are moving to Maine next year. And so for me, it was, I was born here. I've been here for over 3 decades, and it's sort of, there was a little bit of, it's a little bittersweet. The trip was really special, but it was also sort of, in some ways, a bit of a beginning of a goodbye to the place that's kind of molded me over the years. And this campaign in general has been, I would say, kind of in really been that way too, because I mean, I've only been fly fishing for about a decade, but I kind of, in that decade that I've been fly fishing, I've eked about as much out of the Chesapeake Bay watershed as anybody with a full-time job and other things going on can. I think I added it up. I'm somewhere in the last 10 years in the neighborhood of 400 days fishing the Chesapeake Bay watershed. So I think the campaign and especially that trip, I mean, I really savored every second. There were moments thinking about the campaign and being kind of representing FFI and knowing, you know, what was at stake for our organization made it a little stressful, but it was also, there was every day was sort of like, I was every probably 20 minutes, I was thinking, God, I just need to enjoy it. I just stop and smell the roses over and over again. Cause you know, I won't get to do something like this again for a long time. And I certainly won't get to do it around here. I think that was for me, the big takeaway was, it was just sort of a bittersweet, but very loving tribute to the place that I call home and have called home. So moving on, I think let's kind of segue to why people should watch 7 YouTube films and as well as why should they go to IF4 next year and see the full length feature film about the journey that we went on. What would be, you know, Eric, what's your pitch?
My pitch is that it is like nothing you've ever seen in the fly fishing space before. And we did that purposefully. As much as, you know, we love our good or fun, just classic fishing film of going somewhere cool and landing a big fish and kind of just summarizing the trip. This is not that. This is a series about the fish, about the environments, about the culture, and probably first and foremost about the people that make up this watershed. And I guess that's really it. That's just my pitch. It's like nothing you've seen in the fly fishing space before. And it's important. I think I'd like to think it has more depth than just kind of like a fun fishing clip to watch. It's I don't want to say educational because that could turn some people off, but it is for sure. And I think it's very important content for people to watch and for people that maybe don't have the ability to get out there and plan a week and go on some road trip, or maybe don't even have the resources or the people to talk to go to certain fishing spots. Like, it's pretty cool that we get to try our best to get beautiful footage and represent people in a accurate light, to, you know, maybe give some people sitting at home a little bit of that experience that we felt throughout that week.
That was perfect, Eric. I think I'll follow up and say that there's not many fly fishing films out there about the Chesapeake in general. I think a lot of times the Chesapeake is compared to the Northeast in the striper game, and the Northeast usually wins out because they have bigger fish. So anytime there's content to be had on the Chesapeake Bay or to be watched on the Chesapeake Bay, I urge people to go out and experience that and to be able to experience something that doesn't just focus on striped bass, but widens out to a diversity of different, like Eric just said, not only fish species, but environments and cultures. There's not many films that will do that because of what we outlined earlier, and that it's nearly impossible to accomplish what we did. So we really were able to bring a camera along and document something that's probably not going to be done many times in the future. And I don't think it's been done too many times in the past. And to experience something that's a rarity.
Yeah. And my final pitch, you know, just to wrap it up on that is, I think it'll inspire you to come. If you're not from the Chesapeake Bay watershed, I think it'll inspire you to come here and visit. And it'll give you some ideas and some people, you know, or a huge shout out to our guides in the film, who are more than just guides, all of them, but Zach Hoisington, a Cobia guide, as well as a teacher and educator of our country's youth, as well as Jonathan Bland, who just recently got his guide license. Congratulations, Jonathan, if you're listening, who's a guide as well as an environmental restoration specialist. And of course, Grant Alvis, America's greatest UPS driver, as well as one of the two best Bowfin guides in America. Don't take it personally, Grant. I just love Drew Price almost as much, if not as much, as I love you. But you know, just fantastic places that you can go and experience really special fishing. Don't sleep on the Chesapeake Bay watershed as a travel destination. And then if you're from here, I think this film will give you ideas of places you can go for a 2 or 3 day weekend and really explore something special. And it's something that I say often, you know, fish where you are, fish where you live. And I mean, and oftentimes when I'm talking about that, I'm really talking hyperlocal, which is like fish the pond or stream in your neighborhood. But even just from a perspective of like travel, fish where you are can really encapsulate the region in which you live. And if you live in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, you know, and George, Daniel, I'm not trying to call you out by name or anything, but you know, we're chatting in the parking lot before we fished in Central PA, and you said, well, I've never been cobia fishing on the bay, and I've never been for bowfin. You know, those are both, you can do those in a weekend. And I'm not, again, not singling out George, I'm just saying in general, like someone once said to me, why would I go for redfish in the Chesapeake Bay? Why wouldn't you just go to Louisiana? Well, because they're here. So just, you can be there in 3 hours from Washington, D.C. and catch 40-pound redfish. I don't need to go to Louisiana. And don't get me wrong, I'd love to do that too. But you know, if you live in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, watching these films, I think will give you an idea of sort of fishing you may not otherwise consider if you're from a different part of the watershed. So then two more questions. Obviously, you guys know the final question that's coming, but the second to last question, and we've alluded to it a fair amount, about how the sausage gets made of a fly fishing film. And we've talked a lot about the difficulties of filming in 7 days. What would you say to an audience watching? And you mentioned kind of, it's a little bit more vlog style than usual. Although I happen to think the production value is incredibly high, personally, as someone who doesn't make these films for a living. But what would you say is the, if you could have the audience sort of understand one thing about the realities, it's almost like I'm almost asking like Instagram versus reality type question, what people see on the big screen versus the reality of filming fly fishing. What's the biggest takeaway that you could share with the audience?
I would say that when you're watching one of these feature films, the finished product that you're watching was not what was drawn up in pre-production. And, you know, we had tons of meetings leading up to this week-long trip where, and there was so much logistics and scheduling that went into this, and you're trying to control the controllables, but there is a pretty high degree of uncontrollable variables as well. And so you do the best you can with that plan. And then when a thunderstorm pops up, or when the target species is spawning and doesn't want to, you know, act as a sport fish during that moment, or if any number of things happen, you have to be ready to juke and to change up your plan. That's what we did. And at the end of this is like, if we were to plan out the dream trip and the dream fish species that we were going to catch, it's not what we did, but I think that's what makes it uniquely beautiful. And, that's kind of what makes other films beautiful as well. You know, they're not curated to the max.
Yeah, totally. And I think kind of going back to what you were just saying, Andrew, it ended up not being very vloggy. It's kind of sitting at more of a cinematic documentary look right now for each short, which I love. I really like the way it turned out. But you know, Andy, you're absolutely right. It's like, and we kind of knew this going in with a little bit of prior experience, but especially with documentary filmmaking, obviously there's pre-production. You want to have a rough plan. You want to have a structure of the story, stuff like that. But man, do you have to be willing to go with the flow, especially with a week like the one we had, where any one little thing could change it, and we just have to completely change our plans. And I think we are flexible. And as we've alluded to, there is a couple situations between weather and fish, where we had to go back and reshoot, really just one full day to meet up with Pamela and Mark. And then a couple others just to shoot some little stuff to fill gaps in. You know, but at the end of the day, it's our job as filmmakers to produce some sort of cohesive, interesting story that entertains you and fills its purpose. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not like we're going to like try to deceive you or anything, but, we're trying to put those clips in strategically to fit into the storyline so that story can serve the greater message that we're trying to tell. So it's definitely not black and white. It doesn't always go as planned. And like we were saying earlier too, it's, you watch these short clips and there's a whole lot more work that goes into these clips than you'd imagine. And there's little stories for every little moment too. Like as we're sitting here talking, man, could we talk for like 4 days? Just the amount of different stories between, not just the different days, but different moments of catching fish, different funny things that happened. So yeah, there's a lot more that goes into it than what you see.
I think that's a great answer. And that brings us to our final question, the final question of the entire first season of the Fly Fish Forever podcast. I'm going to let you both bring us home. What does the Chesapeake Bay watershed mean to you? And I'll let you kind of go if you guys want to do it together or one at a time, either is fine.
All right, Andy, you ready?
You want to say it on the end? No, you can go first.
So my first answer will kind of be in theme with the rest of the film and, what a very similar answer we heard a lot of our guests come to, and that's the Chesapeake Bay watershed is home to me. Mm-hmm. It's where we grew up, and I'd argue its environments have kind of shaped me into the person I am today. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds cliche and maybe exaggerating a little bit, but I really feel like I'm not. Like it was so important to us and to our childhood, and that never changed. You know, what started out as catching crayfish in the creek or building forts in the woods, like all we did is we just graduated to wearing expensive gear and putting a rod in our hands and doing the same exact thing. Like nothing has changed. It's those environments that have completely shaped who we are. Mm-hmm. And I guess another answer I'll bring up too is kind of the theme of our project, but I think a lot of people, I guess the average person, when they think of the Chesapeake Bay, it's very common to think about oysters or blue crabs or striped bass. Like that's the first thing that comes into your mind. But the watershed is huge. It goes up to like Cooperstown, New York. Mm-hmm. And there's, I believe there's almost 19 million people in the watershed. Yep,
19 million. And
think about the amount of people that aren't right on the bay proper, or that don't have the resources to get onto the bay to, like, you know, catch striped bass or like think mm-hmm. about blue crabs. And not a lot of people cater to the rest of the millions of people in the watershed that are in Pennsylvania and West Virginia mm-hmm. and New York and Virginia. So the Chesapeake Bay isn't just saltwater and blue crabs and striped bass, but it's the mountains of Pennsylvania and it's the swamps of Virginia and it's brook trout and it's bowfin and it's the people that mm-hmm. that are here.
That's a great answer. And Andrew, the last guest to answer this question.
It's going to be hard to follow Eric up on that. That was a great answer. I think for me, the Chesapeake Bay is the most inspiring area I've ever been in. And part of that, I guess, might be because it's where I grew up. Part of it might be because it's an estuarine environment, which means that it's the most diverse next to, you know, rainforest biomes and landscapes. And in culture as well, but there's something about it that constantly inspires me whenever I can make the trip back. You know, here living in Fort Collins, Colorado, I can see Long's Peak from my house, and I can be in Rocky Mountain National Park on the weekends and experience being in an alpine environment where I'm looking around and I feel like I'm in Switzerland mm-hmm. and I can fish for cutthroat trout on dries as I'm watching them, you know, swim in the creek. And it's a heavenly experience. And those are amazing places, but those places are still not as good in my mind as when I'm on the Chesapeake Bay in a backwater habitat where there's an oyster reef and a blue crab scuttling by, and then you see bait fish come in and maybe a few rockfish show up and you sight fish them, and that environment is just perpetually in my mind and is constantly inspiring me, and it's something I consistently come back to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think those are both great answers and really spot on. And Andrew, I take it back saying you were going to be the last one to get to answer the question, because I think I'm going to ask myself the question after 20 episodes. I feel like I owe it to myself a little bit, and I hope people don't roll their eyes too hard at that. But you know, to me, it is, you know, like everyone else has said, it's home, and the Chesapeake Bay watershed has molded me over my lifetime. And I just, maybe it's being an expectant father makes you a little more mushy as you get older, and a little more sentimental. But I just think about, you know, the experiences, the joy that the watershed has brought to me, and it goes way beyond fishing. I mean, it's just my entire life has occurred within, you know, other than travel, has occurred within the boundaries of this watershed. And it really is such an unbelievably special and unique place. And there's lots of amazing, unique places around the world and across the United States, but it's ours and it is spectacular. Andrew and Eric, I can't thank you both enough for being on. It was a privilege and a pleasure to spend a week with you two and the Green Machine, sort of journeying our way around the watershed. To the audience, thank you for sticking with me And with my amazing roster of guests over 20 episodes, thank you so much to our sponsors. I think Andrew and Eric, you would wholeheartedly agree. If it wasn't for FFI and particularly the support of Costa Sunglasses, Joe Gugino in particular at Costa, thank you, Joe, for making this possible. And we really can't thank Cheeky Fishing, particularly Pete Vandergrift, their chief marketing officer, who also is a member of the board of FFI. None of this would have been possible without Pete and his support, as well as Ted Upton, their CEO. Ted, you're the man. Keep it going. And thank you both. And thank you, Cheeky, Costa, FFI. And you will not be hearing my voice again unless I, for some reason, am a guest on a future season of the Fly Fish Forever podcast. It truly has been a privilege to get to be the host for the first season. And I hope that all of you will come back for whoever and whatever we cover in season two. Thank you as always. And I will not see you next week. So, but thank you again to everybody. Andrew, Eric, I hope you both have a great evening. Audience, don't forget to tune in next week for our first episode of the Chesapeake Tales.